From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley in for Terry Gross.
You take one more step, I'll shoot you. That's all I'm going to say.
Marshall, I want to tell you something important.
Today, we talk with Graham Yost, creator of the FX series Justified. It has only 3 episodes left.
This is one of them classic stories where the hero gets his man, then he rides off into the sunset.
Or maybe it's like that other classic, where a guy chases a whale to the ends of the earth only to drown for his troubles.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by Australian singer-songwriter Courtney Barnett, and we talk with the creator of the ABC series American Crime, John Ridley, and with Benito Martinez, one of its stars.
Are you lying?
No.
So that wasn't our car?
No.
Everything he's saying, that wasn't our car? Stop it! Stop lying!
You want to go to jail? Huh? You want to be another cholo in jail?
No. Tell the truth. Tell him what happened.
That's all coming up on Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. The outstanding FX series Justified has only 3 episodes left in its 6th and final season. Our first guest, Graham Yost, is the show's creator and showrunner. Justified is based on the novella Fire in the Hole by Elmore Leonard, who was an executive producer of the series until his death in 2013. Set in the coal mining country of Harlan County, Kentucky, the story revolves around 2 men who worked in the mines together when they were teenagers. Raylan Givens, played by Timothy Oliphant, and Boyd Crowder, played by Walton Goggins. Raylan is now a deputy U.S. Marshal. Boyd is an outlaw whose criminal activities include robbing banks. In this final season, Raylan wants to move to Florida and reconnect with his ex-wife and their 5-month-old child. But first, he wants to bring down Boyd. Terry spoke with Yost last Thursday and began with this scene, in which Raylan pays a visit to Boyd. Boyd is standing outside the home of his fiancée, Ava.
Raylan Givens. Look at you, hopping to like Mr. Hospitality. Must be hiding something good.
Arms aloft in a welcoming stance, not I.
Surely something good is going on inside.
Well, you do have a tendency to interlope in moments of high drama, but this ain't one of those moments.
Do you even know when you're lying anymore, or is it just like blinking?
What do you want, Raylan? Leftover chicken? It's all been et.
What happened to the big bad man? Called out 24 hours to get her done.
Afraid I don't understand your reference, Raylan.
I'm asking where your b****s are at. Are you gonna pull off the job, Boyd, or am I gonna die of anticipation?
Was that why you came? Help me find my b****s.
I came to tell you I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of the bull****. I've been lying to you, Boyd.
Well, now we're getting somewhere.
Keeping up the fiction that I got all manner of things tying me to Kentucky, things that forestall my moving to Florida. But there is only the one thing. You.
You won't lean in for a kiss?
Is that what you think this is? Another one of your love stories?
Oh, well, I do like happy endings.
Well, this is one of them classic stories where the hero gets his man, then he rides off into the sunset.
Or maybe it's like that other classic, where a guy chases a whale to the ends of the earth only to drown for his troubles.
I gotta admit, there's a small part of me that's gonna miss this when it's over.
Well, don't eulogize the past till the future gets its turn.
That's a great scene. Graham Yost, welcome to Fresh Air. I can't wait to see how Justified ends.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Terry.
The end of that scene is kind of like a joke about how is the series going to end? Will it end with the hero Raylan capturing his man and riding off into the sunset? Or will it end more like Captain Ahab, who is defeated by the whale he's obsessed with killing? Or maybe something that doesn't follow either of those narratives. So, can I ask you the kind of feeling you are going to want viewers to have at the end? I can't imagine this being a Sopranos ending that's ambiguous. That wouldn't work in a crime show like this.
No, I was on a showrunner's panel several seasons ago, and Terry Winters was on that, and he was talking about how...
And he did Boardwalk Empire. Yeah,
he did Boardwalk Empire, and he was on The Sopranos. Yeah. And so we were being asked, how are our series going to end? And Terry, talking about Boardwalk, said that he wanted Nucky to live long enough that he could go into a New Jersey diner and kill Tony Soprano. And I said, I don't know how Justified's going to end, but I think I know what song is going to be playing somewhere toward the end, where we got hooked on playing this this great country song, You'll Never Leave Harlan Alive. We used it at the end of the first season and the second season. I think we skipped the third season, but we know that'll play a part of it. you know.
Okay, so someone is going to die.
Well, you know, it's just the question of who will live and who will die.
Right.
And I guess my only sort of thing I say to people is to get a sense of how we might end this thing, read Elmore Leonard. Not because that'll tell you how the series is going to end, but because it's always a good idea to read some Elmore Leonard. But there is, in his world, a certain way of ending things, and we aim for that.
Let's go back to the very beginning of the series and play a clip from the first episode. And, well, you know, when the series starts, Raylan, the federal marshal, has just come back to his hometown of Harlan, Kentucky, and is meeting up with Boyd Crowder, who was his childhood friend. I don't know what to call them, but they used to work in the mines together when they were teenagers. Now Boyd is a white supremacist in episode one. And so there's a scene when they're meeting for the first time in years, and they're now on opposite sides of the law. And Boyd Crowder speaks first.
Yeah, all those days, good and bad, they all long gone now. Everything's changed. It's all changed. Mine has changed. No more falling the seam underground. Cheaper to take the tops off mountains and let the slag run down and ruin the creeks. Hey, you remember the picket lines, don't you? Of course, back into company scabs and gun thugs. Whose side do you think the government's always been on, Raylan? Us or people with money? And who do you think controls that money? Who do you think wants to mongrelize the world?
Who?
The Jews.
What? You know any Jews?
See, I recruit skins. They don't know no more than you do. And I have to teach them that we have a moral obligation to get rid of the Jews. See, it was in the Bible.
Where?
In the beginning. It's part of creation. See, in the beginning, right, you had your mud people. Now, they were also referred to as beasts because they had no souls. See, they were soulless. And then Cain, now you remember Cain now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cain, he laid down with the mud people. And out of these fornications came the Edomites. Now, do you know who the Edomites are?
Who?
They're the Jews, Raylan.
You're serious?
Read your Bible as interpreted by experts.
Oh, you know, boy, I think you just use the Bible to do whatever the hell you like.
Well, what do you think I like, Raylan?
You like to get money and blow shit up.
That was Timothy Oliphant as Raylan, the federal marshal, and Walton Goggins as the white supremacist Boyd. So Boyd isn't really a white supremacist anymore. If he is, he's kind of keeping it to himself. He's not about that. So what happened to the white supremacy stuff?
You know, when we first talked to Walton about playing this part, he was hesitant. He didn't want to play a Southern cracker who was a white supremacist.
Actually, let me stop you there. I asked him about that when I interviewed him. Let me play that clip. I asked Walton Goggins about playing a white supremacist, and he said he didn't want to play him as a white supremacist. He wanted to play him as someone who's a bit of a Svengali and doesn't necessarily believe what he purports. So here's what Goggins said.
Initially, when this was sent to me, I wasn't interested in playing another Southern guy labeled as a racist. You know, I think racism is a problem throughout our country, and it's not confined to those states below the Mason-Dixon line. And for me, I did not want to perpetuate a stereotype. So I had them take out references to our president, Barack Obama, and I wouldn't say the N-word. And I said I would do this if Raylan was able to point out that Boyd doesn't necessarily believe that which he is saying. And that was very important to me. And the other thing that I wanted to explore with Boyd was to explore his intellect. And I don't think that that was there in the original pilot. It was tweaked very easily, with a couple of different sentences here and there that explored how smart this guy really was. That was important to me, more so than that was interesting to me. It's to be a racist didn't interest me.
So that was Walton Goggins in 2010 on Fresh Air talking about his reaction to the character that he plays on Justified. when he was first offered the part. And my guest is Graham Yost, the creator and showrunner of Justified, which is on FX. So when Walton Goggins presented those concerns to you, what was your reaction?
It really fit in with how I was looking at Boyd anyway, which is it's more interesting to me if he is using the skinheads, as cannon fodder in his desire to rob banks. And in that first episode, in the pilot, Boyd doesn't go into the bank. He sends two other guys in. He blows up a car first to distract the law enforcement and then drives up to the bank. Two other guys go in and do the dirty work and come out with the money. And I just liked him as this character who was manipulating other people. And when we decided to keep Boyd alive, because that was a big decision, when we shot the pilot, Boyd was dead at the end of the pilot. And then we tested the show, and we'd all just fallen in love with Walton and the chemistry between Walton and Tim, so we decided to keep him alive. And what emerged was the notion of this character, Boyd, as being someone who will come up with a new scheme, a new way of looking at the world, and he'll seem to totally believe it, but it can be very different from what he had been doing in the past. And, you know, the big evolution became when, in the second season, he started to fall in love with Ava. And that's really been sort of a central question of the series, is does he really love her? Or is that just Boyd talking himself into yet another framework in which he can view his life?
In talking about Justified, another thing that happens on the series is, like, there's been a lot of, you know, pretty sadistic violence over the years. And I'm wondering, like, what's your standards for when violence is justified on the show and for how graphic to make it?
You know, FX is basic cable, and they have concerns about violence, and they'll say, you know, why, when they read a script, they'll get a note back saying, you know, watch the level of gore on this. And when we've shot something, they'll say, be careful to modify this or that. But they do sort of let us be violent. And Elmore's world is a violent world. You know, in the best Elmore scenes, you think that something is either going to take a hard turn into romance and some kind of liaison, or it's going to take it the other way and go into violence. And there is often something oddly humorous about the violence in Elmore's movies and in his books. In Justified, sometimes we were just brutal, and we would just have someone shoot someone, and it was just kind of awful and sudden. But the best moments for us, the ones where we kind of nod and say, yeah, Elmore would have liked that, and we got a kick out of it, would be things like at the end of season 3, when it's Raylan versus Robert Quarles, played by Neil McDonough, and Quarles has got this slide gun on his arm, kind of like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver. And he's dragged Raylan up into Noble's Holler, which is where this sort of African-American community in Harlan that we made up loosely based on something that used to exist there 30 years ago. And the chief, the head man in that community is Elston Limehouse, played by Michael T. Williamson. At any rate, it all comes together in this slaughterhouse because Elston Limehouse runs a barbecue joint. And we had this scene where McDonough has his slide gun, and he sees someone coming in who he thinks is going to turn the tables on him, and he whips out the slide gun, shoots that one guy, and then he's turning it over on Raylan, and we had Limehouse swing out with a cleaver and chop off his arm, which is pretty brutal. But what made it a justified scene that we were very proud of is that we had, and they improvised it, that Neil, playing Quarles, reached with his good arm for his severed arm, and Raylan just pulled it away out of his reach. And it's such a bizarrely funny and horrific moment that kind of sums up what we would be going for when we were doing scenes of violence.
Elmore Leonard, you know, has written a lot of really colorful, small-time criminals. And some of them are not very smart. And you have some villains on your show who are very smart and others who are really dumb. One of the super dumb ones is a character who sadly got killed this season. And I'm thinking of Dewey Crowe. Describe what Dewey Crowe was famous for in the series.
Dewey Crowe appeared in the pilot, played by Damon Harriman, who's a young Australian actor. So it's always disconcerting or off-putting when you're on the set, or you get thrown when you're sitting next to him and he's talking in his thick Australian accent, and then he goes on to the set and becomes full-on Dewey Crow. But yeah, he's just a numbskull. Dangerous, but a numbskull. But he was in the pilot, and we decided to keep Dewey around and keep him in the mix throughout the series and just use him, you know, occasionally, not too much, because he was just this wonderful character we didn't want to wear out. And the great thing that Damon did with him is that he didn't play him as ridiculous at all. He played him absolutely seriously. He felt that Dewey absolutely believed his craziness and was fully invested in it. And there was a scene last year where he's trying to kill Wade Messer, and he prays to Jesus saying, just let me kill this guy and then I'll do whatever you want. Completely unaware of what exactly he was saying. And it was a hard decision to kill him off.
So let's hear a scene with Dewey from this season. And Dewey is part of a group of cousins who are all involved in nefarious stuff, and he's the only one who's survived until this point. Everyone else has been killed off, and he's just gotten out of prison. And as he gets out of prison, Raylan is there to greet him.
Thank you, Jesus.
Come and stop, Dewey.
Christ, Raylan!
How's it going, amigo?
We ain't amigos.
Oh, so you speak a little Spanish. That must have come in handy down in Mexico.
I got no idea what you're talking about.
Better alley named Aguilar says different.
Hey, my lawyer told me you come within 1,000 feet, that's harassment.
Best back up.
They got cameras all over.
His description fits you to a T. Nazi tattoo, funny hair, stupid looking.
That could be 10,000 people. How am I supposed to read that? It's in Mexican.
You just have to take my word for it.
Mexican government wants to extradite you back to Nuevo Laredo, put you on trial for the murder of Johnny Crowder and a truckload of others.
Well, I ain't never been to Mexico in my life.
That's not what's in question, dude.
I didn't kill Johnny Crowder.
Well, then tell me who did. Maybe I can help you out.
Yeah, I ain't a rat. And like I said, I wasn't even there.
Then you get yourself a problem. I can give you maybe a week to jog your memory. And then it's off to a Mexican jail. And we both know that's a world away from and tequila.
Yeah, I'm done talking. I got a bus to catch.
You're a card in fate's right hand. Don't you see how it's going to play out?
What the hell does that mean?
It means you need to be smart.
What I need is a $6 a smarter move I cannot imagine.
So that's a scene from this season's Justified, and Justified only has 3 episodes until its series finale, and my guest Graham Yost is the creator and showrunner of the series. So, you know, the writing is just so much fun on Justified because everybody speaks very colorfully and says things like, you're a card in fate's right hand.
Yep.
And, you know, that's the kind of dialogue Elmore Leonard is famous for. But, you know, Elmore Leonard, I don't know how closely he worked on the show when he was alive, but, you know, he died in 2013, sadly. So even if he worked closely on the show, he couldn't work with you for the past couple of years. Can you talk about what the process is like of trying to write dialogue that is both threatening and kind of funny and colorful and also is just like, you know, verbal fireworks?
You know, I think to a degree over the course of the seasons, we've kind of gone farther even than Elmore might have into the colorful nature of the language. But I have to say, we just had so much fun doing it. And there are certain characters, and specifically Boyd. Boyd is just a blast to write because, there was a line that, in fact, I wrote in season 4 where a character says to Boyd, man, you'll use 40 words when 4 would do. And you know, it can be a bit of a trap for writers. We can kind of get into it almost too much and have to peel it back a little because we don't want to go way over the top, although I'm sure at times we have. But it's a great freedom.
Yeah, another characteristic of Boyd's style of speaking, it's not only wordy, it's very ornate and very formal, even though there's almost always a veiled threat underneath it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that clip you had of Walton talking about how smart Boyd is, we quickly decided that he would be self-taught and he would like to read books and he would like to use big words and correct people on their grammar. And, that also gave us license to have Boyd really flower it up.
Mm-hmm.
And Raylan does it, too, in a much more direct and sort of homespun way, also inflected by his years as a law enforcement officer.
So in the years that you were able to work with Elmore Leonard, did he give you advice about plotting or dialogue?
No, Elmore was, you know, listen, he had spent probably 10 years in the 60s and 70s writing screenplays for Hollywood, and he got out of that business because he didn't like getting notes. And so he understood that it was...
And notes are the feedback that you're given, like you can't say this, you should do that.
Yeah, let's change this character, move this scene around, do this, you know, do that. He hated getting notes. And so he lived by that, and he didn't give us notes. The only tussle, the famous tussle we had over the pilot was the hat, that he saw much more of what's called a businessman Stetson on Raylan. Basically the kind of hat that the troopers were wearing escorting Lee Harvey Oswald when Jack Ruby shot him. And we tried that hat on Tim, and it just didn't look great. It didn't look as good as a more regular cowboy hat did. That was about the only big fight we had with Elmore and the whole thing. I joked with him after he'd seen the pilot and he really liked it. And I said, well, of course you like it. I used 90% of the dialogue is from you. And because I felt that if you're going to adapt Elmore Leonard, man, use as much as you can of him. I always felt that that was the great thing that Scott Frank did when he adapted Out of Sight and Get Shorty. And Quentin Tarantino, in doing Jackie Brown, he changed the character's name and ethnicity and the title of the whole thing, but he kept a lot of Elmore's dialogue. And why not? The man just wrote great dialogue.
You know, you mentioned the Timothy Oliphant hat in Justified. When I interviewed Timothy Oliphant about Justified, I asked him about the hat, and he said that every time he saw Elmore Leonard would say to him, don't be afraid to lose the hat. You know, a gust of wind could pick it up and blow it away, and you'd never see it again. And Oliphant said that he interpreted that as Elmore Leonard saying, don't let the hat define the character.
Well, yeah, Elmore's thing was he didn't want it to be McCloud. If you remember that series from back in the day with Dennis Weaver, who was playing I forget where he was from. I think he was from Texas. And he comes into some urban environment and he's still wearing his cowboy hat and he kind of stands out. You know, Elmore didn't want that. And I think that that's one of the reasons why Kentucky kind of works in the hat, while is kind of out of place. Most people who wear baseball caps. But it doesn't feel ridiculous. It's not Raylan in Manhattan wearing that hat. And we came eventually to kind of a rule, which is if he's on the job, he's wearing the hat. He doesn't wear the hat indoors much, unless he's on the job. But if it's his personal life or he's in the office, no hat.
The hat goes along with the dialogue where everything's like a little bit bigger than it is in real life.
Yeah, Fred Golan and I were talking once about Justified and the reality level, and I said, I think we're about 2 feet off the ground. You know, we're not really grounded. This is not real. It can have feeling of reality, but it really, the goal of the show was to be fun.
Well, I'm really looking forward to see how Justified ends. I'm sorry it's ending, but it'll be great to see the finale and what you do with it. Graham Yost, thank you so much for the show and for being on our show.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Graham Yost is the creator and showrunner of the FX series Justified, which only has 3 episodes left in its 6th and final season. He spoke with Terry last Thursday. Courtney Barnett is an Australian singer-songwriter in her late 20s who's just released her first full album. It's called Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit. Barnett fills her songs with details about things she observes around her. Everyday details that rock critic Ken Tucker says she somehow manages to infuse with a freshness rare in any songwriter, let alone one this young.
I'll lay you awake at 4, staring at the wall, counting all the cracks backwards in my best French reminds me of a book I skim read in a surgery, all about palmistry. I wonder what's in store for me.
Courtney Barnett is, in her scrupulously precise and somewhat modest way, a daring artist. She fills her songs with close observations and striking images. In a swimming pool, for example, she says she, quote, sunk like a stone, like a first owner's home loan. Barnett makes indecision and ennui vivid, feelings you recognize in yourself but rarely hear articulated in pop songs. That's called Nobody Really Cares If You Don't Go to the Party, and how right she is, eh? Its chorus of I Want to Go Out But I Want to Stay Home is a tiny manifesto of indecision, the artistic joke and triumph of the situation being that by choosing those words and by surrounding them with guitars and drums and a brisk melody, she's jump-started her inaction into action, the creation of a song. Barnett begins songs with what might seem unpromising lines, such as, I stare at the lawn, or in the one I just played, Jen insists that we buy organic vegetables. But very soon, further details accumulate and a mood is established. If Barnett was writing short stories, she might be seen as a natural consequence of Mary Gateskill or Raymond Carver or Alice Munro. But she's making music. And in every one of her songs, a theme emerges from the interaction between the words, Barnett's spoken vocalizing, and the pleasurable grinding of the guitars, which speed up or slow down as the scenario demands. In this sense, the most literary of her efforts here may be Elevator Operator. Like the elevator operator in her song who presses the button to the top floor to go out on the roof of the building for, Barnett says, perception and clarity, Courtney Barnett is forever trying to clear her head and make herself understood better. We all benefit from the heroic efforts she makes to be as forthright, honest, and yet as understated as possible. And if I haven't been clear, this is one of the best albums I've heard in the year thus far.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Courtney Barnett's new album, Sometimes I Sit and Think, and Sometimes I Just Sit. Coming up, we talk with John Ridley, the creator of the ABC series American Crime. And we talk with Benito Martinez, one of its stars. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Then
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, John Ridley, is the creator of the new ABC series American Crime. Ridley won an Oscar for his screenplay for 12 Years a Slave. Our other guest, Benito Martinez, is one of the stars of American Crime, playing the father of a boy implicated in a murder. Martinez also is known for his roles on other TV series, such as The Shield and House of Cards. American Crime revolves around a case where a young man has been murdered. His wife, who was beaten and appears to have been raped, is in the hospital, where she's still in a coma. The story isn't so much about solving the crime as it is about the social and racial issues that shape the lives of the victims, their parents, the suspects, and their families. The victims are white. Three young men are arrested in conjunction with the attack: an African-American meth addict, a Latino high school student, and a Mexican youth supporting himself through illegal activities who fears being deported. Nearly all the characters are part victim and part aggressor, and hold stereotypes and preconceptions about the others. Terry spoke with Ridley and Martinez last Tuesday and began with a scene from the first episode. The murdered man's parents, Russ and Barb, played by Timothy Hutton and Felicity Huffman, have just been interviewed by a reporter covering the murder. Barb has told the reporter that she was left alone and broke to raise their two boys after Russ gambled away their money and left the family. As Russ and Barb drive away from the interview, he's angry that she told this to the reporter, and they start arguing. Barb insists that he stop the car. She runs out, and he follows after her.
Don't you walk away from me. That was 20 years ago. I am not that same person.
I am not here for you.
Listen, I admit I had some problems.
Problems? Say what you did. Say what you did. Say what you did. You gambled away everything we had, then you went and stole so you could gamble more. You were off in Vegas.
It was an illness, Barb. It was an illness. It was an addiction, and I got myself help, and now I am recovered.
We had nothing raising those boys by myself in public housing. Do you have any idea what that was like? Huh? A white mother and her two white kids. Do you know what those people did to us day after day? Do you know how those people treated my boys? I am here trying to do what I can for Matt. And your feelings are hurt over what I say to reporters.
Barb, come on.
Stop saying my name. Now is easy to be a father, Russ, when all you have to do is stand in front of people and be sad.
You think this is easy for me? Do you have any idea how hard it was for me to earn back the love and the trust of our boys? Our boys! Now get in!
This must have been so hard. Just stay out of my way!
That's a scene from American Crime. John Ridley, Benito Martinez, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. John Ridley, the characters in American Crime, there are families that are African-American, Latino, white. You have people who are Christian, secular, Muslim, atheist. You're getting at so many different points of view, and many of them are in conflict with each other. We just heard Felicity Huffman's character say that she raised her sons as a minority member in a housing project. You know what that was like. You know how they treated us. She thinks that her son was murdered because he was basically the target of a hate crime, an anti-white crime. And there's no talking her out of that. So you have a difficult juggling act here because you're trying to understand so many different characters coming from so many different backgrounds. And I think trying to be sympathetic to everyone, although you wouldn't necessarily agree with everyone.
Well, to your point, yes. And in the clip that you played, you have Tim Hutton and Felicity Huffman talking about their past, talking about their relationship, two parents of one of the murder victims who are trying to reconcile their estranged relationship. And as you say, Felicity is talking about her perceptions of how she was treated as a single white mother raising her two white kids in public housing. Things that she say can be interpreted and may very well be bigoted, but coming from a place of true experience, as opposed to someone who maybe grew up in an isolated suburban area, never had a true interaction with people of color or people of a different faith, but has certain belief system because that's how people in their surrounding area believe. She believes very clearly that what she feels is a direct result of her environment, and she cannot be dissuaded of that. And she's a mother who is very passionate about trying to resolve a set of circumstances for a very specific reason because of her kids.
I would like to bring into the conversation now Benito Martinez, who plays the role of Alonzo Gutierrez. He's the father of a teenage boy who is now one of the suspects, even though we, the audience, know how he's been implicated in this, but we're pretty sure that he is not guilty of what he's being charged, which is being an accomplice to murder. I want to start with a scene, Benito Martinez, that you're in. And you've been raising your two children alone since your wife died. Your son and your daughter are teenagers now. Yes. You're very strict with them. They think that you treat them like babies, and they're starting to rebel. So after this murder, your son is stopped by the police in the car that's the vehicle implicated in the murder. One of the cops asks the son for permission to ask him a few questions, and the son agrees. And then they've called you, and you come in, and the detective also asks you if he can ask you a few questions, and you agree. And here's the rest of the scene.
Now, your son was stopped driving this car. Is that car in the possession of your garage?
I tell him to drive it around the block when he has to, but he knows he's not supposed to be on the street with that.
And you recall personally operating that vehicle outside of your property this past Sunday?
Sunday, no.
Would anyone else have had access to the vehicle?
We have the keys, nobody else.
Well, Mr. Gutierrez, your son told us that he wasn't at home on Sunday night. Do you recall if Tony was home with you?
No, he wasn't at home.
Mr. Gutierrez, do you know where your son was?
Oh, he told me he was working on the car.
Tony, were you working on the car, or were you out riding around in it? Tony was telling us that it's just you at home, is that right?
Yes.
My wife and I, we were recently separated, so I know how hard it is.
No, it's different. We didn't... My wife, Roberta, had a heart thing.
I'm very sorry about that. Mr. Gutierrez, we need your son to tell us what's going on. If he tells us what happened, if he tells us the truth, then that's that. But if he lies to us, that's going to be a problem.
Papi, yo no hice nada.
Oh, not like that. If you have something to say, you say it. Are you lying to them? Are you lying?
No.
So that wasn't our car?
No.
Everything he's saying, that wasn't our car?
Nada.
Stop it. Stop lying.
You want to go to jail?
Huh? You want to be another cholo in jail?
No.
Tell the truth. Tell him what happened.
I don't know.
What did you do?
Nothing. You never let us do nothing.
I just wanted to make
some money for myself.
Antonio, was that our car?
Yes.
We always told him. Him and his sister, we always told him, stay away from gangs, stay away from drugs. Roberta and I, we came to this country the right way, the right way. And we always told him, do things the right way.
Yes, sir.
So he'll tell you whatever. Whatever it is, he's going to tell you.
Wow.
Yeah. That's painful to relive, I have to say.
Why?
The beauty of the scene is that, you know, the father comes in, he steps in, and he thinks he's doing the right thing. He's going to stand up and take care of his kid. And initially, he's like, oh, you were just driving the car around the block. Is that what this is about? Yeah, I gave him permission. It's just a car. Yeah. Yes, I know he doesn't have a license. That's fine. We're fine. And quickly, things start escalating.
And in trying to teach his son respect for the law, respect for authority, that honesty is always the way to go. He basically extracts a confession from his son without a lawyer present. And then the son is just like locked up and accused of being an accomplice to murder. So like the father has unknowingly done the worst thing imaginable for his son in trying to do the best thing for his son and teach his son a lesson. Benito Martinez, I was wondering if there are any experiences you could draw on as a father or as a son in playing this role.
Well, when I first read it, the kid, played incredibly by Johnny Ortiz, I knew him right off the bat because that's who I was when I was a kid. I was not a bad kid. I had a lot of energy. I was very close to my dad. My dad was very much a yes, sir, yes, ma'am, you know, follow the rules. He went into the army, and when he got out, he was... everything had a proper place. So even though Alonzo's not exactly my dad, there were elements to that that I immediately understood. And then now I'm also a father of two teenage girls. What is great in the piece is that the love that Alonzo has for his kids and for his life and for doing the right things is the pillar, is the staff that he uses, the staff that he wields. And when it's not the fix-all for everything, he has to try something different, and that's the growth that ends up happening in the family. But he goes through a heck of a lot of terrible things before that growth can happen.
Your character is very proud of the fact that we quote, came here the right way, meaning as opposed to people who came here illegally and could be deported. Because even he has stereotypes about other Mexicans who cross the border.
Who may have gotten here a certain way and they're not legal about it and everything else. And that's he's proud of that. He's proudful in so many different ways. And it's, I want to be sensitive to the fact that people, you know, have their own realization and their own labels that they like to give themselves. I know people who've come across and they just want to be Mexican and they never want to get a green card. If they get the green card, they never want to be fully become a citizen fully. I know others who were born and raised here but will never say Mexican-American. They said that they're Mexican. I know I just met a guy the other day. He was born in Michoacan. He moved out here, was raised with his mom. And I said, so are you Mexicano? And he says, no, I'm Mexican-American. I identify more with the American culture. So I'm familiar with that in a large way. But as far as an immigrant story per se, you know, I'm from New Mexico, and the border moved on us. You know, we never crossed a border. You know, old Indians and old Spaniards, and, you know, when the border was north of us, we were Mexican. And then when the border moved south of us, we were New Mexican and American. And this was, you know, the same for Arizona and parts of California. And that's my immigration experience. I don't have any roots or family from south of today's Mexican border.
Benito, have you had trouble getting roles at any point in your career?
Well, Russell Crowe keeps getting all the roles I really want. that guy, damn him. You know, when I got out of drama school, I thought, you know, here I am, classically trained in London. I'm going to come back. I'll be the next Raul Julia, the next Anthony Quinn. You know, put me on stage. Put me anywhere. I'll do it all. And and I would go into auditions. I was like, yeah, I went to Lambda. And they go, where's that? I'm like, huh? You don't know the best drama school in the world? And they would say, oh, is that theater? No, this is not theater. We don't want theater actors. And I didn't understand. And early on, you know, I'd go reading for a role like Chewie, the gang member, and I had an English accent. That would be, hello, I'm Chewie. I'll be your, let me just, orale, put your hands up. Okay. Thank you very much. And I would leave. And they were like, they would call my agent, like, what is he doing? What's his act over here? And they're like, what did he do? So then I would go in, I wouldn't speak, and I'd just go, yeah, hello, what you want? And then, you know, that was my audition, I'd leave. And, you know, I was 21-year-old actor, 22-year-old actor, and all the roles that were for me were just, you know, gang members or you know, waiters or something. As a struggling young man who happened to be Mexican-American, probably from across the border or in trouble. So thankfully, I ended up in a movie called Mi Familia, when I played the young Eddie Olmos. And it was Jimmy Smits and Isai Morales and Lupe Ontiveros and just a who's who of actors written and directed by Gregory Nava. And I really, you know, it put me on the map of a Latino actor who was serious immediately after I got a movie called Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman, Morgan Freeman. And between those two movies, within the course of a year, I was able to then do a lot of theater and live off residuals and be a lot more picky about what I was going to do.
That worked.
it ended up working, you know. But I love the whole capacity of it. I grew up in the mariachi. I was playing guitar in my dad's band when I was 8.
Wow, really?
So I would do that. And then the next week they'd say, can you learn the guitarrón, the other instrument over here? And by, you know, a couple of months later, I'd learn that instrument. I was playing trumpet in the marching band. So doing that and working in the theater and having this house that, you know, we were all just crazy artists and everything else, that's where I'm most comfortable.
So I want to ask you both, John Ridley, Benito Martinez, you've both done your share of crime dramas. And John Ridley, I mean, your thing, you started off writing crime fiction. And American Crime isn't really a crime drama per se. It's really more of a character story with a crime at the center of it. But anyways, I'm wondering if either of you have had experiences with being a victim or experiences with being in the criminal justice system that have helped inform your work, you know, as, you know, actor, writer, whatever.
I would just say I have never had anything happen to me like happens to the characters in this show. I hope that none of my family members ever do, and I hope people who are listening to this right now never do. But part of being a writer is that creative extrapolation of things, of feelings that you have, whether it's something like crime, whether it's about family, whether it's about faith, whatever. Not been involved with it much. I can only imagine what it's like, and I can only say I'm very thankful that that's where it ends, with my imagination.
Personally, I haven't had things like that happen. I have never seen the inside of a jail cell, and I've never been arrested. I've never had handcuffs put on me. But I have been stopped because I was a Latino in the wrong neighborhood before. I have been pushed against a wall because I was probably the wrong color skin in the wrong place.
But can I ask how you handled that?
I'm blissfully ignorant, so I never think that, you know, it has anything to do with my skin color. I just kind of go, oh, well, you just got the wrong guy. And I just, and I'm like, you're not talking to me. And the guy's like, yeah, I am talking to you. Can't be me. I didn't do anything. I'm not sure what's going on here. that was odd. I've been the victim of stereotype profiling. I mean, I was mowing my lawn and somebody pulled over and said, doing a great job.
Can I get your card?
And
I went down the block.
This is my house. And they went, oh, you own the house. And they said again, doing a great job, very slowly so I would understand, and then drove away. And I've been outside in front of a restaurant, you know, I'm out there wearing a nice suit, waiting for my car, and some lady comes up to me with a mink coat, and she hands me a ticket. She goes, it's the Mercedes. And I'm looking at her like, what is, you know, and what's happening here? I don't know you. And she looked me up and down again. She goes, oh, no, you're too nicely dressed. And just did a 180 and walked and just went up to another guy.
Wow.
And I'm standing there going, was she asking me to get her car? Those things happen. I was holding the door open for a guy one time. And he says, how come you didn't meet me at the car? And I'm like, this was in Utah. And it was in front of a hotel. And I was like, I'm not understanding you, sir. What's going on? Do you know me? And he thought I was the valet. There have been different times. And just people make gross assumptions based on where you happen to be standing and the color of your skin and this, that, and the other. That happens. That's life. You know, if I'm honest, I probably make the same assumptions daily.
Well, Benito Martinez, John Ridley, thank you both so much and congratulations on American Crime. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for everything.
Thank you very much.
John Ridley is the creator of the TV series American Crime, which airs on ABC Tuesday nights. Benito Martinez co-stars in the series. They spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.